The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 196.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi, guys. Welcome to today's live stream. Thank you for joining me. Okay, so just want to remind everyone to check out my new channel, Rebel Capitalist. That's where we're doing 2 to 3 news stories per day. Don't edit them. I just pull up something that I think is interesting, hit the record button, and then upload. Bam, right to YouTube. So if you guys want my thought on recent events, things that are happening in real time, then definitely check out that channel. All right, let's dive into the questions here. Okay, Zero Hedge, Maloney Reddit saying the world's greatest short squeeze is coming in silver and started on Friday. Do you own any physical silver? What are your thoughts? So I don't own any physical silver. I just stick with gold. Not that I don't like, so I'm definitely thinking about it. I think silver's interesting. And as a speculation, potentially, the miners, the gold miners even, here's the thing with the short squeeze. I don't know that I would expect a short squeeze like GameStop. I don't think you're going to get one of those because there's just, you'd need more money thrown at it. You'd need more people. The market's a lot bigger than just the float of GameStop. So although it's fun to think about for people who own precious metals or silver in this case, or the miners, I don't know that it's going to go up 1,500% in 2 days or 3 days. But I do think that you could get a bit of a squeeze. It takes it up, I don't know, 100%. And I don't know how long that would last. Any of these short squeezes, it's kind of a game of musical chairs. Now, do I think that they're going to put out all the big banks out of business, like the JP Morgans, who are short silver contracts and don't really have any idea or any intention or don't think it's possible that they'd ever have to deliver on the contracts that are outstanding, the underlying silver? I have a tough time believing that, but anything's possible. I think it's just a matter of probabilities. My big concern with all of these is that the individual or the retail investor gets kind of sucked into it at a peak right before it's about ready to crash, because that's usually what happens. And now I think Schiff made a great point today where he said, listen, the silver short squeeze isn't like GameStop because silver is a good value right here. And I agree with him for sure. And, you know, it's not like buying a bankrupt company or a company that's close to bankruptcy and that you're not buying it really because of the underlying asset. You're just buying it because you think it's going to pop 1,000% because of a short squeeze, where silver, I think, is smart to own right now. So, again, I just, my concern there is that people start watching the story and the average person just starts getting involved. Usually the average person starts to get involved when it's time to get out. And it's just, that's the way markets are. They figure out a way to hurt the maximum amount of people possible. And whenever you know, just go to any of your normie friends, right? Once they start talking about GameStop or anything else, usually that means that it's time to start selling. So if you're thinking about, and see, another thing, I don't know that, well, personally, I would never buy a stock or silver for that matter, just because I thought there was going to be a short squeeze. Never, never, ever, ever. I'm not saying you can't make money at it. Obviously, a lot of people have, but it's just not my style. I just buy things when they're cheap. I don't buy things because I think a ton of liquidity is going to come in because of a Reddit forum and drive the price sky high. That's just not how I operate. And I'm not saying that it's wrong. I'm just saying that's not what I do. And it takes me back to my blackjack days, where it's really not whether you win or lose a hand. That's irrelevant. It's just if you play well. And if you play well, if you play each hand correctly, then over the long run, you're going to come out ahead. You have a mathematical edge, regardless of whether or not you lose a hand or two or three in a row. This just doesn't matter, or you win two or three hands in a row. It's about playing correctly. And for me, playing correctly just means sticking with the 10-80-10 and buying things when they're cheap and selling them when they're expensive. You're getting paid 80% of your portfolio to own it. And I just stick with that. And I think over the long run, that gives me a mathematical edge. Now, if I stray from that and start getting involved with all the Reddit forums and, oh my gosh, this is AMC is going to go up next. Let's pile into that. Let's go into this. Now, all of a sudden, I'm way off my game. That's not how I invest. And I get caught up in the hype and the emotion. And I don't have an edge there. And if I continue to do that long term, because to me, that's not playing correctly. And although I might win a few bets, if I continue that, in my opinion, the odds are against me and I'm going to end up losing money. And again, I want to be very clear. I'm not saying that you shouldn't play that game. It's totally up to you. You be the judge. Just realize that usually when, you know, the average Joe starts coming into the trade, that's usually when it's time to get out. And let's keep in mind, I want to make this last point here. What was the best performing asset class or the best performing sector in the stock market since the mid-1990s? What was it? Tech? No. It was tobacco. Tobacco. So just you take that, all that cash flow, all those dividends, and when you reinvest them and they compound, the best thing you could have purchased in the mid-90s when they had all those lawsuits and everyone hated it, they said that it was uninvestable. The average Joe, if you would have told them back in the mid-90s, hey, I'm going to buy tobacco, they said, you're crazy. No one's smoking cigarettes anymore. That's a dead industry. They've got all these regulations now, and they've been sued, and they have to pay out billions of dollars, and that you are crazy. See, you would have done better than everyone else. And it goes back, you know, usually what happens, and since I've been investing in 2012, what I've noticed is when I go into investment and everyone tells me I'm crazy, I make money. I make a lot of money. When I go into an investment and people are like, oh yeah, that's a great idea. Yeah, how can I do that? Yeah, that, man, I see all these guys making money. Yeah, let's do it. And you always lose money. So I would just ask yourself right now, if getting involved with a short squeeze specifically because you're getting in, because that's your motivation, not that you really want to own the underlying asset long term, I just ask yourself, are you, you know, why are you doing this? And are you, does everyone hate it right now? Or is everyone on that bandwagon as well? And so, you know, are you buying GameStop or are you buying tobacco? I'd rather buy tobacco. Do you think countries like Russia, China will jump on Wall Street bet train to destabilize markets? I don't know. I mean, my opinion on Wall Street bets is people are angry. People are pissed. And I think a lot of their anger is misguided. I think a lot of it's like Occupy Wall Street, where they're down there pissed off at Wall Street, where they should really be pissed off at the Fed and they should be pissed off at the government. That's the real problem. And also, I don't really understand why they're thinking that if they hurt a hedge fund, that it's somehow getting back at the man, or it's somehow hurting Wall Street. You're helping Wall Street because, I mean, you don't think hedge funds are in there that they hire people to go into Wall Street bets? I mean, really? You don't think that hedge funds are front running all of the call buying? You don't think that other hedge funds are taking this opportunity to sell when, you know, sell short GameStop at $500 a share or you know, higher if it spikes up. They're front rank. They're getting all of those trades from Robinhood or any of these $0 brokers. The hedge funds and the high frequency traders are getting the trade flow milliseconds before it happens, so they can front run you. This is, people who say this is hurting Wall Street, they just don't understand. It's on aggregate total, it's helping Wall Street. This volatility, when a stock goes from 400 to 150 to 300 to 500 to down, blah, 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 blah. Listen, the guys at JP Morgan Trade Desk or Goldman Sachs are just licking their chops and just printing money. They're turning into the Fed. They're printing money. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't be a part of Wall Street Bets or anything. I'm just saying, well, let's be on it. Let's understand the reality of what's going on. And then, before you really get behind the battle cry and the narrative, let's make sure that we're focused on reality and not what we want reality to be, because often those two things are completely different. So my point there is, I don't know about other countries destabilizing it. I think that a lot of the people in Wall Street Bets that are stoking the fire, so to speak, are hedge funds pretending to be martyrs, just because, and they don't care about Wall Street or they don't care about the narrative. They don't care about the what you're trying to achieve. They don't care about the mission. They just want to manipulate the price. And I think that there are a lot of these retail guys are in there thinking that they're reading posts from other people who are just like them, when really it's just hedge funds that are in there pretending to be someone just to manipulate you. I think that at the end of the day, that's kind of what we're dealing with. But who knows? I mean, we'll see. Again, it's, if you want to play the game, just keep in mind it's a game of musical chairs that you're playing, and sooner or later the music's going to stop. So tell us a story about when you lost everything, or the clash with the politician, why he singled you out. Also, in your early stages, how did you skip venture capital and deal directly with banks? So that was 2009. And why did he single me out? Well, I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. He was trying to run for office, or higher office, I should say. And he wanted to get press. He wanted to get in front of the media. And he kind of saw what I was doing and said, here's what I can do. I can attack this guy and totally spin the reason and not be honest about it. And I can lie about it, and that'll give me a lot of press with the media, and I'll look like a hero just because of the spin. And who cares if I put this guy out of business? Who cares if all of his employees are out of work? Mind you, in 2009, these politicians, they don't care about anything other than themselves. That's all. You have to understand that. They will do anything. They will destroy any human, any group of people. They will destroy their state. They will destroy their country. They don't care about anything other than gaining power. It's crazy. I don't care if you're on the right. I don't care if you're on the left. They're all the same. And like I said in the video the other day, you have to realize that, or if you don't realize how much they're manipulating you and trying to brainwash you, and just how unscrupulous they are. They don't have any morals. They don't have any ethics. If you think they do, and if you think they're actually trying to help you, and they're actually trying to look out for the little guy or some group, whether it's an ethnic group or they want small, maybe it's an ethnic group on the left, and on the right, maybe it's free markets or lower taxes. If you think that's what they truly believe, you are lying to yourself more than they lie to you to buy your vote in the first place. So, you know, it's about time we look ourselves in the mirror and realize that the people that we're voting into office, they're the bottom of the barrel, period. They're the people who are gravitating towards power, and they're not gravitating to producing things and being a benefit to society. They're gravitating to a position where they can have power over other people. That in and of itself should tell you what you need to know about their personality. So the gentleman that I clash with, he is the quintessential politician, and he just saw an opportunity and he took action, and he just did not care about, he couldn't care less, like doesn't even lose a minute of sleep. Just whomever he has to destroy, he's going to destroy if it gets him a step closer to more power. So that's what happened. And as a result, through PR, and the main thing was that I was setting up a convention, and I had millions of dollars out. And then what you do is you people pay for to show up. It's like a Freedom Fest or something like that, right? Where the people they pay to show up for the 4 or 5 days, and then you just, you know, you got to have all the outlay for the event, and then you keep about a 10% spread, right? Well, what this politician made me do is he made me refund everybody, every single person, after I already had the event. If you're a business owner who has that type of business model, and basically you deliver a service, let's just use a restaurant as an example. Okay, let's say that you had to come in and you did business for a year straight, and you had to give people their food. They paid, you know, just normal course of doing business, a restaurant. But then at the end of the year, you had to refund everyone. So you'd be out of business pretty fast, right? So, yeah, I mean, 2009, I went flat broke, and I had to, bring on I just did what I needed to do to bridge the gap and get some, capital on board to survive, because the model still worked. And then between 2009 and 2012, I made it all back. I retired. And, I tell people that it's I was poor my whole life. I didn't have anything. No one ever gave me a dime, a penny. I had to make it all myself. And so... but I know what it's like to be super poor. I know what it's like to have to scrounge through your couch to find change to put gas in your car, or to go to the store and get top ramen or something. Yeah, I get that. I've been there. Trust me. That is a lot easier to handle mentally than when you go from that point up to having everything at a very young age. You know, being a multimillionaire, having the Lamborghinis, having the Ferraris, living in the $2 million condominiums, you know, going out on the town, you know, hanging out with celebrities, doing all that. You go from poor to that life in your early 30s, right? And then you lose everything. You go from living in the $2 million condo to whatever, 3-4 months later, you're living in a $600 apartment in the ghetto. That's tough. Mentally, that's when you got to do a gut check. And most people do that gut check and they give up. And they say, oh, I'm just going to give up. I can't do it. The politicians are too powerful. They're too strong. Or whatever it is. You know, the man, fill in the blank. It's the world is against me, and there's nothing I can do about it. So I'm just going to give up and go back to a job, and just, you know, that's what's easy to do. And trust me, that's the devil is on your shoulder whispering that in your ear the entire time. You get the self-doubt, you get the depression that goes along with that. very few people will have to go through that in their lives. And I wouldn't wish it upon my worst enemy, because mentally it's brutal. It's absolutely brutal. But you've got two decisions. Either you can make excuses the rest of your life and be miserable, or you can just grab, you know, I won't say that, but, or you can just say, you know what, F it. I'm going to go back out there and I'm going to be 10 times stronger, and F the politicians, F you. I don't care if I'm living in a $600 apartment. I don't care if I'm dirt broke, if I'm broke, if I'm dirt poor again, I don't care. You do anything you want to me, it's not going to matter, because I'm going to get back on my feet and I'm going to kick ass. I'm going to kick everybody's ass. Those are your two decisions. So, and what's weird is when you say it out loud, everyone's like, oh yeah, well, the latter, that's what you do. No, that's the hardest. That's a very, very hard path, because it, you know, even to wake up in the morning and to, you know, to work the 12 and 14 hour days to try to figure out a solution, and the stress that's involved, it's tough. But fortunately, that's what I was able to do. And, you know, one of the reasons, I'm going way off on a tangent here, but one of the reasons was because during that time, I just needed to, you know, get my North Star again. I needed to take a quick break and just mentally recharge, right? And this was when I hadn't yet really, you know, I was trying to come to terms with what was happening, because I was so angry. I mean, I was obviously, you know, you can imagine how you would feel if that happened to you. And so, you know, everything that I'd worked so hard for. But anyway, I needed to regroup and just figure out what is going on here. And it's before I really made that decision that I'm going to go back out and kick everybody's ass, right? And I'm going to make it all back, and I'm going to prove to everyone, I don't care what the odds are, I'm going to go make it happen. So it was before that, right? So I went up to Moab, Utah, which is one of my favorite places. And I was hiking, and I was up, I don't know if you've ever been to Arches National Park, but there's all these canyons and everything. And I thought, and there was this cliff, like, I mean, it was like a 2000 foot cliff that went down like this, straight down. And there was this sandstone, and I was trying to get to the top up here, but there's this sandstone kind of grit, you know, kind of not an edge, but this kind of, you know, where it was at an angle here. And I thought that it wouldn't be that hard to come on this sandstone and then kind of just go sideways, traverse, and then walk up. But unfortunately, I didn't realize that the sandstone was a lot slicker than I had realized. And I got to about the middle of it. I couldn't get up, and I started to slide down. And there was about, I don't know, maybe 10 feet between where I was and the edge of the cliff that dropped straight down, call it 1,500 feet, 2,000 feet, something like that. I mean, 1,000 feet, I don't know. You know, it was, you're done. It's game over. And once I started to slide, it just, within a split second, it dawns on you, go from, oh, I'm just going to get to this peak right here. And in a split second, you're like, holy shit, I'm going to die. And I had my cell phone. Of course, you're out in the middle of nowhere. You don't have cell phone coverage. And I knew that even if I could call someone, I don't have that long. Like I can't. And you're sliding. And I wasn't sliding down quickly. I was just barely sliding out. And I was hanging on. You know, you try to catch a little rock or something like that with your hand just to hang on a bit. But then your arm would get tired and start. And so then you switch arms and you realize, okay, well, I can't keep this up. And so, I don't know. I mean, it all happened so fast. And after about, I don't even know what it was, maybe a minute, I don't know, 2 minutes, something like that, I'm like, the only thing I can do right now is yell for help. That's it. That's my only, it's either just yell for help out of desperation and pray that there's someone out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, I was probably an hour from the parking lot. Nobody around me. I mean, you guys, if you've ever been to Moab, you know, out there in the middle of nowhere, you know what I'm talking about. So I just started yelling for help. And sure enough, probably, I don't know, man. It seemed like forever. And I was, my arms were so tired. There was burning. And, but I knew if I let go, I was just going right off the edge of the cliff. And I don't know if it was 2 minutes, 3 minutes, it all just happened so fast. But I was yelling, and all I could hear was my echo. And then I heard someone respond. And they, I could hear they were at a distance. And like, where are you? You know, what's going on? And I was yelling to them to you know, what was happening. He's like, okay, just hang on, I'll be right there. And I remember the last thing I yelled to him is I said, you need to get here fast because I'm not going to be able to hang on much longer. Just because I wanted to make sure he understood that this was a very urgent situation, you know, and I don't know how long it was. Maybe it seemed like an eternity, but maybe 2 minutes, 3 minutes later, something like that. I saw him at the top, and he was a professional rock climber that was out there practicing. And he like just he saw where I was, and he immediately knew the problem. And that it was very, very urgent, you know, but he had run there out of breath, and he just, I don't know what he did, but he just, you know, ties up the ropes, and then he kind of put one around his body, and then he goes down. And as soon as he got to me, he just put his arm around me and bam, put the rope around me. So even if I did let go, I'd still, you know, the rope would be there grabbing, you know, my arms and whatever. So then, you know, and he was a kid. He was probably, I don't know, 19, 20 years old, something like that. And so he got me down to where I started. And yeah, I mean, what do you do? How do you thank that person? You know what I mean? I said, dude, you just saved my life, man. And he's like, oh, no, no, no. This is no big deal. I'm sure you would have figured a way out of that one. I'm like, no, I would not have figured out a way. So anyway, if you've ever been to Moab, everyone at the end of the night always kind of goes down to the Moab Brewing Company to have a beer and just kind of talk about what they did. So this kid was there with his girlfriend, and they were like camping or something. It's like, you know, meet me there. And I bought him dinner. And then at the end, what I did is I brought an envelope with me. And I remember I went to the ATM machine and took out like as much money as I could out of the ATM. And it was like, I don't know, you know, $1,000 or something like that. And I put it into the envelope. And keep in mind, this is when I'm going broke. I mean, I don't have that much money, but I'm like, you know, how do you repay this person? So I gave it to him, and I gave him my email address. And you know what was funny? About maybe 6 months later, and this is when I kind of started to turn the corner. I'll tell you in a second, but he emailed me out of nowhere. And he's like, you know what? I just need to thank you because I was in a really, really bad spot financially. And we didn't even have money to pay the rent. And that $1,000 that you gave me allowed me to pay the rent. And it bought my girlfriend and I another month to where we could find a job and get back on our feet. And we were actually in Moab just kind of clearing our head. And I'm like, wow, that's pretty powerful. You know, so anyway, because I had that experience when I was coming back to Phoenix at the time, and you know, thinking through what my next steps were and what happened with this politician, it put things into perspective. I'm like, you know, all that stuff that I was worried about and all, you know, losing all my money and all, you know, dealing with this politician and everything, all the bad stuff that had happened, it didn't seem like that big of a deal. And so I said, you know what, if I can come that close, now I know what's really important. And that's just your life. Life is short, and you never know when you're going to just, you know, when you're going to get hit by a bus or fall off a cliff or whatever. You realize how precious life is, and you realize what's really important. And I said, you know what, screw it, that what I've been worried about, it's not that big of a deal. If I can make it once, I can make it again. And that's what really triggered my mind to making the decision that I was going to take the hard road. And I didn't care what was going to happen. I was going to go out there, and I was just going to, you do whatever you want to me. And I'm going to break down that wall, and I'm still going to be successful. I'm going to make it all back. So between 2009 and 2012, that's what I did. I made it all back. And in 2012, pretty much down to the penny when I had, and there were other reasons for me hanging it up. But that was one main reason. I remember looking at the bank account and seeing that I had the exact same that I started with. I'm like, okay, I'm out. I did it. Done. And so that's kind of the I guess, the long story. And it's even more extensive than that. But that was kind of what happened with the politician. As far as the, and, you know, it's all the saying, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Very true. Very true. In the early stages, how did you skip the venture capital? Well, I had saved my own money. And I remember the first business that I had that did really, really, really well, where I needed about 500 in working or to start the business. And I had about 100 saved up. And so I put all my own money into it. And then I borrowed 400 from a guy that I had done business with that, you know, and if I told you the terms of the 400 I borrowed, you'd be like, it was crazy the interest rate I was paying. In fact, you know, I laugh about it because I was so confident in my own ability that I didn't care what the interest rate was. You could have charged me 100% interest per year and I would have still done the deal. Because I'm like, yeah, screw it, I'll pay it back, no problem. I'll handle it. And I think 99% of people out there would have never started that business because they couldn't have got the 400. And if they could have got the 400, it was at such an astronomical interest rate that they would have said, there's no way I'm doing that. I did the opposite. I'm like, screw it. It took me all about a half a millisecond to the guy said, okay, here's my offer. Here's what I'll do. I said, fine, done. Wire me the 400. I'll do whatever, you know, whatever. Whatever payments you want me to make, I'll make them, done. And I think, you know, that was a huge decision looking back in retrospect, because that was the first business that I had. That I had some businesses prior to then that had made money, but not like insane money. And that was the first one that made insane money. That's funny. So anyway, long story short was I had about 100 saved up. And then from this guy that I'd done business with in the past, and I had made him a lot of money working for him as a consultant. So he knew me, he had confidence in my ability. And I was able to, in fact, he even offered me the money because I sold a business for him. He said, well, what are you doing next? I'm like, well, I'll probably start something on my own. And he's like, okay, can I give you the money? I'm like, yeah, sure. And then that's when he just said, okay, here's the term. We were just at dinner. He's like, okay, here are the terms. You got to pay me this much every single month. I'm like, okay, done. Wire it tomorrow. And that was about all the thought I gave it. So anyway, yeah, maybe a fun story. I don't know what the lesson is there, but but the lesson is I'm probably insane. That's the lesson. All right, so we took a massive detour there, guys, but hopefully you got some value out of those stories.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Do you have any thoughts on investing in farmland in the United States? Also, which country would you recommend? Yeah, you know what? I was talking to Simon Black the other day, and he made a really interesting point. He's like, listen, if you're selling blueberries, as an example, which is, I think, one of his crops that he has in his farm in Chile, he says, listen, you're selling at the market rate. So I mean, if the blueberries are selling for whatever, $10 a pound, whether those blueberries are grown in Chile or Colombia or California, they're still selling for $10 a pound. So why would you buy land in California at, you know, I don't know what land costs, I'd say $10,000 an acre, when you could buy in Chile for $500 an acre and your labor costs are a fraction. So if you're interested in the farmland stuff, I don't know. Or maybe I should say, if you're interested in farming, then maybe you might want to look outside the United States, just kind of that arbitrage, that geo arbitrage. If you're looking for specific to the United States, I'm not sure how it works. I don't know that the yields are fantastic. I think, although I like it because it's a hard asset, I like it for a lot of reasons. I think right now there could be some better opportunities out there that have more tailwind that would benefit if the macro picture benefits farmland, right? So if farmland's doing well for XYZ reason, this other commodity will also do well for XYZ reason, but will probably do better in the interim as far as cash flow, and then might even do better if those events come to fruition, right? Meaning stagflation. But I don't know a lot about it. Let's see. Also, which country would you recommend buying a place if you could be self-sufficient if you leave the U.S.? Well, I mean, I think Uruguay. I was talking to someone the other day. Where was I? Maybe was that Jake Doozy? I was talking to a big YouTuber, and they were saying that they had done a lot of research on Uruguay. And if you're worried about self-sufficiency, that was one of his favorite spots, because like 90% of what they consume in the country is produced in the country. And I like that. So I might look at Uruguay if I was you. And I know Doug Casey lives down there. And, if it's good enough for Doug, it's definitely something we should at least look into. Yeah, burr investing is great, Sean. I mean, that's exactly what I was doing back in 2012. And the only thing now, though, you got to realize is that the majority of the real estate in the United States, and now I obviously you can find a motivated seller and get a great price, but most of it's expensive. It's super expensive, historically speaking, and adjusted for inflation. And so I know you're going to be using debt, but just make sure that debt is a 30-year fixed rate. And see, one of the great things about doing this back when I was doing it in 2012, when I started, is the real estate was so damn cheap, and that I was forcing so much appreciation, even at a 70% LTV, I could take out all my money. It was insane. So you could go in there. I could buy, I'll use simple math. I'd buy a house for 50 grand. I put in 25, so my cost basis is 75. The house appraises for 100. I go back to the bank. I say, hey, let me get a cash out refi for 75. They go, okay, there you go. I get a free house. I got a house. I got a renter. I got cash flow. And I got the $75,000 in my pocket that I started with. Pretty good deal. I could go do another house. So that's the way you pull off the burr strategy. And that's the way that you can get so many roofs in your portfolio, if you will, is you don't need that much money, because you just take the same money and do over and over and over and over and over again. Now, you got to be good. You got to know what you're doing in order to pull that off. And it's almost impossible to do it now. But that's the strategy. When the market settles down a bit, you know, we get some more inventory, prices come down. That's exactly what I do in Colombia, although I don't use the leverage. So that's a little different there. Yeah, I shouldn't say that. It's a similar strategy, but it's a little different. But if you're in a market where you can do a 30-year fixed rate loan, you can refi at that. I like it. But just understand though, that the property itself is now your liability. So be very, very, very careful. You understand that you might be buying at a top, and then just understand that the debt is your asset, and you're most likely going to make more purchasing power on the debt than you are the property, because you're getting that debt at such a low interest rate. And if we get price inflation or rent inflation, stag inflation, there's going to be a delta on the rate of inflation and your interest rate. And the delta is purchasing power at the end of the day that goes back to you. So you're making money on that debt. You're increasing your purchasing power by paying the debt back with cheaper dollars. And remember, you're not paying it back. Your renter is. So I'm not, and it's weird because I'm not one that says, oh yeah, go out and take on debt. I'm not that guy. I'm old school. I'm like, you know, I don't really like saying that, but it is what it is. That's just the world that we live in right now. And if you're not an expert, don't do it, because you're going to get burned. You got to be very, very careful. You got to understand that you're playing with fire, I think. How's the birthday party? The birthday party was incredible. It was absolutely phenomenal. I mean, like I said at the top, that you know, my local friends were there. I had some, just tons of awesome people that I know from Phoenix. And then we had probably 100 people from the community. And I mean, the gifts were great. In fact, I should just go grab it real quick. This guy gave me a hat just like this one, but he wrapped it in tin foil. it was great. So I got a tin foil hat. But I got so many really cool gifts, and I mean, books, the books people gave me were just, it was humbling, to say the least. It's just surreal that anyone would even watch this YouTube channel or any content I put out. I still can't really believe it, but, you know, it's all about community. And that's what I told everyone last night, that, it's not about me. It's about you guys. It's about all of us, just building a community. We'll call it the Rebel Capitalist community, and just like-minded people coming together and sharing ideas and trying to figure out the world around us so that we can build wealth and thrive in a world of out of control central banks and big governments. That's what it's all about. And if I'm the person that had to set up the YouTube channel to bring all the people together that make up this awesome community, then fine, so be it. But it's not about me. It's about everyone there last night, all of you on the live stream right now. It's about the Rebel Capitalist community. And that's what, you know, I'm all about. And I just want to grow that community so we can get the word out and inform more people as to what's going on so they can make better decisions for themselves in their future and hopefully not get into the same position that I was in 2009. Because back then it might have been a politician. In the future, it could be a politician. It could be the World Economic Forum. It could be the IMF. It could be, I mean, just right now, and I was listening to my buddy Andrew Henderson's podcast, and he was talking about the wealth tax that they're proposing in California that could potentially affect people who are only there for 60 days. It's getting insane. But anyway, you get my point. So it was just amazing to see people in the community and be able to share time with them and share such a fun experience. So if you were there, thank you very, very much for your time. I understand that that's our most precious commodity in this world. And I realized that very quick in Moab when I was on that cliff. So the fact that any of you would choose to take time out of your schedule and to trade your most precious commodity for just 20 minutes of watching my video, it's incredible, and it means a lot to me. So thank you. Next question here. What type of range can you foresee the DXY trading next 3 to 6? I think maybe, I mean, anything's possible. As far as if I had to really say what's within the range of kind of what that I would say is probable, I'd say 80 to 110. Then more probable, probably 85 to 100. That's what I'd say. Looking to use potential rise of dollar to invest overseas. Yeah, but see, again, there you're trying to time the market, and you're trying to predict a price, and I don't know if that's a good idea. I would far rather look at an opportunity overseas and say, listen, is it cheap? And, is it cheap with the dollar at 90? And if it's cheap with the dollar at 90, all right, go ahead and pull the trigger. But if you need the dollar to go to 100 in order for the, or 110 or something, for the investment to make sense, I don't know. I don't think I'd do it. I like doing things where it makes sense today. The day you buy it, it makes sense. So nothing has to happen. Zero. Let's go back to 2012 with the real estate that I bought. So I was putting in, and keep in mind, these are really nice houses in nice neighborhoods. Just little basic houses, 1,000, 1,200 square feet, little three bed, two bath ranch. Nothing extravagant by any means, but just a little starter home. And in a neighborhood in Kansas City, good school district, not in the ghetto at all. And I was buying them for 50, 55 grand, putting in 20, 25. So my cost basis was 75,000, roughly. Sometimes I go up a little bit, but let's just use that as a kind of an average. So I've got 75,000 out of pocket, and I'd rent them out for $1,000 a month. Listen, so my point is, I'm making an investment. I'm buying an asset. It makes sense from day one. It doesn't have to appreciate in order for the investment to pay out or pay off. It doesn't have to. It doesn't have to do anything. The market doesn't have to do anything in order for that investment to work. Even if the market goes down, for heaven's sakes, if you had that type of RV ratio, if you had that type of yield right now in this market on a piece of real estate, and I said, yeah, you've got that yield, but the nominal price could go down by 10%. You'd be like, okay, who cares? Sign me up. It's the same thing back then, right? My point is, the price didn't have to do anything in order for me to win, because it made sense from day one. So that's what I really like. I would encourage you guys to maybe consider that for your own portfolio with the 80% side of it, right? It's not the 10% gold, that's insurance, and it's not the 10% speculation. The 10% speculation doesn't make sense right now. There's asymmetry. You're not getting paid to own it. But with the 80%, it makes sense from day one. Until MMT happens, where they spend money into existence instead of lending it, do you think real estate is more overvalued than U.S. dollars that are in circulation? Do you think real estate is more overvalued than the U.S. dollars that are in circulation? I'm not sure how you're connecting those dots. I would encourage you to listen to the last Macro Voices episode with my good buddy Eric Townsend and Russell Napier, because they talk about stagflation. They talk about the government limiting the lending that the commercial banking system can actually do, so they become the main creators of M2 money supply. They, meaning the central planners, the central bank, the treasury. I think they're going to basically merge, or they'll effectively merge, whether they say that or admit it. Excuse me. And so, historically, the commercial banking system is responsible for the majority of money creation, right? But in the future, that's most likely going to go, or that could go away, where the majority of the money creation, the government, the central planners are responsible for that. And that's how they kind of try to tackle inflation while at the same time doing MMT. Okay. He sees a world in the United States in the future where we could have price controls again. And I think that makes a lot of sense. So, I mean, it's just like it's a rewind of the 1970s to a certain extent. And how did housing do in the 1970s? That's what I'd study. I'd look at that. And it did okay. It kind of went up, down a little bit. Pretty much stayed consistent with the rate of inflation. The stock market got crushed 72 to 74. So I would just kind of look at that. And I don't know if I'd go so far as to say that would be my base case. because I totally get what Snyder and Brent Johnson, my buddies, are talking about. And they're a hell of a lot smarter than I am. And I think the dollar could spike for sure. But I just think in 10 years, we're going to look back over this decade, and it's going to be a decade where the majority of it, we saw significant inflation, especially in a consumer price inflation in the things that you buy daily, like the food. And that's, I say unfortunately, because, you know, it's one thing if the cost of cell phones are going up. Huh? Okay, big deal. You buy a cell phone every 3 years or something, right? Or computer, you know, those are the things that are depreciating. Unfortunately, the things that you really, really need to live, that's the price that's going up, rent and food. And fortunately, we've gotten a break because energy prices have been relatively low. But my goodness gracious, now no one, you know, oil is uninvestable, according to the ESG people. Okay, great. Well, what's that going to do to the price of oil? It goes up to 80, 120, let's say, a barrel. Or 100 or 120 a barrel. I mean, now all of a sudden you've got super high energy prices, you've got super high housing prices, and you have super high food prices and continually going up. You see? So, and then you have structurally high unemployment because they're locking down an economy. And I personally think in the next 10 years, they'll probably lock down the economy, they'll lock it down a couple times again. And not that we're, you know, hopefully we get COVID in the rearview mirror, of course, but what's next? And I'm not saying this implying that there's anything nefarious. I'm just saying that since 2003, we've had, what, like 9 or 10 of these things, whether it's this flu or that flu or H1N1, you know, any of these things, they pop up every 2 years, pretty much. So, and before, we didn't do anything about it because we're like, oh, swine flu, who cares? That's in China. It's in, you know, totally oblivious. It's out of sight, out of mind. It doesn't affect us, right? You think Americans are going to have that mindset the next time there's a bird flu in China? Absolutely not. And in my opinion, no way. I think we're moving into a stage in the United States and in other developed worlds where that's going to be their default. It's going to be shoot first and ask questions later, right? So instead of, oh, no, we're not going to lock down the economy. What are you talking about? No, that's just over in China. Let's just wait to see what happens. We'll see if it's a big deal. Then we'll look at the data, and then we'll decide what we need to do. Now, we've gone from that and, oh, don't worry about it. That's just, who cares? You know, bird flu, whatever. We've gone from that to, I think in the future, it's going to be, oh my God, and CNN, of course, will plaster it all over the front page of everything. And every politician will be like, here's some headlines that I can use to get more power. And then they're going to look, oh my gosh, it's coming over. Oh my gosh, we had our first case in California or in Hawaii. Shut down the flights, shut down the restaurants, shut down the bars, shut down everything. And we just can't risk it. It could be Cervasa sickness 2.0. We can't risk it. Let's just shut down everything. And then we'll collect the data over the next 2 or 3 months. And then see if we can, if it's safe enough to allow businesses to open up. And if it's safe enough to allow people to come out of their homes. I think that's going to be just the default now. I hope I'm wrong. I mean, you guys know that. I hate this. I can't stand it. And I mean, I'm not here to give an opinion on the severity of the Cervasa sickness. You do the research yourself, right? But from day one, and I started talking about this way, not before everyone, but you know, when I was being called a tinfoil hat, and guys like Dr. Chris Martinson and my buddy Eric Townsend, we're all being called tinfoil hats for talking about, you know, when it was just exclusively in Wuhan. And, you know, but even back then, before the data came in where you didn't know what was going on, I still said, it shouldn't be up to the government. They should give us the data and they should allow us to make our own decisions. If you have a business and you want to require people to do X, Y, Z, fantastic. go ahead and do that. If you want to shut down your business, great. If you want to lock yourself in your home, great. If you want to go out on the beach, that's fine too. You analyze risk for yourself, and you, the government isn't our babysitter, right? So even since from day one, that was my concern. And I talked to Chris Irons about this in the very beginning on his podcast too. I remember this very, very vividly, because it was difficult to figure out what was going on or what we should do, because we didn't have any of the data back then. All we knew was this R-naught value was through the roof. And I said, listen, I just think the government should stay out of it, because if the government gets involved, it's going to have long-term huge negative ramifications if you're someone who believes in personal liberty and freedom. It goes right back to the Patriot Act. It's going to be Patriot Act 2.0. And I think, unfortunately, it's going to be the Patriot Act on steroids. But again, I hope I'm wrong. I apologize for this live stream today, guys. I really went off on a tangent. I know some of you like tangents, so you might enjoy it. Other people were sort of say, oh, George, just stick to the questions. You get to more of them. So next week, I'll do my best to focus on answering more questions and kind of just giving you one or two minute answers. I just thought that, a couple stories that I haven't really gone into in great detail. And if you're an aspiring entrepreneur, hopefully you'll get some value out of that and maybe get some, that'll inspire you. My story will motivate you to go out there and tackle those challenges that you face on a daily basis, because I've been there, man. Been there, done that. I get it. I've got all the gray hair to prove. I've had the sleepless nights. I've maxed out the credit cards for payroll. I've battled the politicians. I understand the daily grind and the nonstop fight that it is to be an entrepreneur, a producer, especially now, and create jobs. So anything I can do to help inspire you to go out there and kick ass and add value, because you are the growth engine of our economy. I mean, if we're going to get out of this hole that we're in, if we're going to rebuild the economy, the only people that can do it are the individuals and the entrepreneurs. That's it. That's it. Without them, we're done. So anything that I can do to be of service or help you guys go out there and rebuild this economy and you know, on a structurally sound foundation, you know, that's what I need to do. So that's why I kind of went off on those tangents. But let me go and do some shout outs, guys. And we've got Steve 50, Mr. John, John Wayne. talking about a guy that goes out there and kicks some ass. Devorah, Brandon Smith, It's All on a Whim. Steve S., Max Bootstrap, Rusty Pranger, Mo Raff, C. Parobi O, John Sweatin, Thomas Gurman, Rasa Wergler, Nick Baker, BB Silver, Eagle, Terry Williman, COB Havenevans. I'm sure I butchered that one. Sorry about that. KK237, Praddock is here. I always see Praddock on here. Nicholas Mickelson. I think I see Nicholas here all the time. All Nighter Heater. We always see him here, or she. Mr. Jeremy Desjardins. I'm going to assume that's Spanish and say Desjardins. Hopefully I'm getting that right. Penny Pinchin Prepper. All right. Matau Ballinger Camden also in the house. All right, guys. I got to take a break and then go over to Rebel Capitalist Pro for the member live stream. Just remember, do me a huge favor. If you want to check out my take on the daily news 2 to 3 times a day and a live stream every single day, right around 4 or 5 o'clock my time, Phoenix time, check out the channel Rebel Capitalist. Thanks for hanging out with me. See you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.